Thank you to our sponsor, Closeaway Outfitters. Closeaway is a Uruguay wing shooting experience that goes beyond expectations. Welcome back to another episode of Save for the Blind podcast. This is your normal host, Carson Odegaard, with my co-host, Jeff Smith. And today's guest is Corey Overton, who is CWA's science director. So, Corey, welcome to not only the podcast, but welcome to CWA as well.
Thank you. I'm glad to finally make it over to CWA after many years in California.
Yeah, you've probably been working alongside us for a long time.
Long time. Used to drive around your vehicles all the time when I first got here.
Were you a tech when you first started?
Yeah. I came here in 99 for one of the first satellite tracking projects in California. It was the first time I'd worked with ducks, never duck hunted, and came here, lived in the bachelor quarters on Grizzly Island Wildlife Area and tracked the whole Delta twice a day, every day for a whole season.
And what year was that?
That was 99 to 2000. I remember the New Year's Day 2000, the Y2K, I was in the middle of the Delta and realized I'd have no idea if the world ended because there was nothing around me.
But you said you had never done anything with ducks before that or no duck hunting experience. So why come out here to do ducks?
I grew up in Colorado and went to high school in Reno. And I always thought I was going to work with big game or something in the Rocky Mountains. And following tech jobs around the country is a lot of new graduates do. And ended up lucking into a job out here and ended up in Sassoon. And 28 years later, I'm doing the same stuff. So,
now, are you a waterfowl hunter now dealing with it all?
I am. Yeah. Actually, I had one goose hunt in Colorado before I came here, but my first real duck hunt was on Twitchell Island. I got drawn out there in 99 and had a phenomenal solo hunt with borrowed decoys. I think I was wearing a blue jean jacket and I maybe had waders, probably the ones that were donated or that were part of the project. And despite all of my best intentions, and I'm sure people thought somebody dying with a call in the blind, I managed to do pretty well for myself. Unfortunately, it hooked me, so I stayed and I've been here doing it ever since.
Well, good. So give us a little overview of kind of your background with some of the other agencies and kind of what your role there was.
Yeah, so I worked for the USGS in Colorado doing some tech jobs, small mammal stuff, and then with universities at Oregon State. Came back here, came to California, like I said, in Sassoon in 99 and worked for the USGS, and I've pretty much been there ever since. Had a great set up there working for a great guy, Mike Casaza, who retired last year. And, you know, he really kind of brought me through from being a, you know, 12 months out of school, green and not knowing anything except for I was one of the few guys who never got the truck stuck. So I think that's why he kept me around. And he ended up finding a good project for me after that PINSAT, the first year project during the summer. Of course, there wasn't much tracking to do, so at least not on ducks. And so I worked in the Sierras on band-tailed pigeons. That turned into a master's degree at Oregon State University, developing a protocol that's still used to count them every year. Then I came back and worked on a variety of things for Mike and the USGS, including sage grouse, garter snakes, cranes, whatever came my way. Ended up starting work on an endangered species in the bay that lives in the tidal marshes, the Ridgeway rail, and did my PhD at Davis on those. And this whole time I was getting paid by the USGS, which is a scenario that just doesn't seem to happen anymore. It was a great boss, great system, lots of luck. I'm really fortunate to have made it through all that. And Mike retired last year, and the program has been a phenomenal success. We've been marking birds, got back into duck tracking in 2015, and we've been doing it ever since. And it really kind of felt like coming home. It was a good spot to be for the last decade.
And Corey, with your new role with CWA, kind of what does that entail, and will you be working on some of those projects that you're working with USGS?
Yeah, it'll be a lot of the same type of stuff I was doing for a portion of the job. The job's got kind of three different roles. One of them will be research, so I'll continue to kind of bring in the science and work on collecting data and finding out the new questions and new answers to those questions. The second part will be extension. So we'll be trying to apply a lot of the findings that we have and figure out problems for wetland managers and agricultural producers that are doing things to help waterfowl in the state. Then the third part is education and academia. I'll be working at UC Davis to kind of train the next generation of wetland and waterfowl professionals. And my role there will be to kind of provide the real world laboratory and real world problems to the sort of theoretical and book learning that they'll be getting through UC Davis.
That's amazing.
So you'll be like the field professor instead of the in class.
Yeah,
you'll be the fun guy.
hopefully that doesn't just mean mushrooms, but yeah, I will be working hand in hand with the Raveling Endowment Chair, Kevin Ringelman, who's there. So the two of us will be kind of sort of tag teaming this program and taking a program really further than I think most other universities are going to be able to do it. It's really a fortunate spot. We're really the non-endowed chairs across the country are going to start being lost over the next several years as people retire and age out. A lot of the universities aren't really looking to replace waterfowl programs. Wetland programs probably so, but this focus that we've had on waterfowl is disappearing, and it's disappearing pretty quickly, except for the endowed chairs. Being one of the people who can help kind of build the bridge between students and waterfowl and channel their energy and ingenuity towards problems that I'm too old to think about maybe on in some cases is kind of a opportunity that I can't really pass up. It's super valuable right now because we're going to need these folks in the future. And they're not going to just come unless we put effort towards it.
And all those non-endowed chairs that are, kind of going away as people retire, is it just a funding thing where they just don't want to fund the position?
It's a combination of things. It's, waterfowl isn't the priority in a lot of places the way it used to be. There's only so many faculty and there's an ever increasing number of problems. And so it's maybe a little bit of an overstatement, but waterfowl have done comparatively well in the last several decades. And they don't get the attention that a lot of other problems do, at least. And so universities are playing whack-a-mole trying to hit problems that come up, and that oftentimes means switching priorities and switching away, even if it means switching from what's been working, which would be my argument. The fact that we have these people that are focused on waterfowl is what makes the people, the professionals, do their jobs well. So I'm really worried about losing that. It's not a skill that you can just learn on the job. You really need to have a bit of training in order to get it. Mm-hmm. Really important landscapes too, like Alaska. I don't think we have a professor in Alaska that's working explicitly on waterfowl. There are some that work on it tangentially, but that's kind of scary. It's a pretty important spot.
I would say so.
Let's explain telemetry data for folks that may not know exactly what it is before we hop into it too deep.
Sure, yeah. So telemetry is a term we use for putting a device on a bird that allows us to relocate it. In the old days, we used to do this with radios, really old-fashioned radios that would basically just be a beacon. And we would have to figure out what direction the beacon was and move to a couple different locations to try and triangulate. So by getting different directions towards something from multiple different points, we can estimate where that's at. Kind of like dead reckoning with a sailor. And that old style was incredibly useful. It was used for decades. Relatively simple with batteries that could last forever, but it required a bunch of yahoos like me driving around trying to figure out where these animals were. And it was not super accurate. Took a while to get the information, and the birds could move in between, or you might not get the best locations. Telemetry nowadays usually means having a device that can actually record, like GPS, and then transmit that information off. And so there's still like GPS radio tags that might just store it and then send it through a radio signal. So you still have to be close and kind of drive around and find it. Or the tags that we use are GPS cellular. So they communicate via the cell network. So as long as there's a connection, the tag can offload. There's also satellite tags, which don't require the cellular infrastructure, so they could work even in the high Arctic. And that's what PINSAT was. PINSAT was the first large-scale waterfowl satellite telemetry project. And so it allowed us to mark birds down here in the winter and figure out where they were going to breed. And the only other way that we had to do that in the past was through banding. So we could put a bunch of bands out here, and then we could figure out where those bands were by recapturing them in the Arctic, but that required that you had somebody up there to catch them and required a lot of banding. And particularly in the Arctic, it's a target-rich environment for birds to try to nest. And so being able to find them up there is pretty difficult. So the satellite tags are what was developed in the late 90s and by 2000 was when the PINSAT project started, and our late 98, I think, was the first tags, and 2000 to 2004, I think, is when that project really kind of hit its stride. And comparatively, we were kind of putting bricks on birds' back. They were big units, required a big battery. They didn't necessarily last quite as well. They also used a technology that was not GPS. It was called Doppler shift, kind of like you ever been close to a railroad track and hear a train go by, you know, that train sounds one way as it's coming towards you and sounds a different way as it's going away. That's the Doppler shift. And so by having satellites that are listening to a tag, as the satellites move past, they're basically acting like the train, and they can triangulate based off of when that tone changes where the transmitter's at. And so it can be relatively accurate if you're talking about the whole globe, but we're talking on the order of several hundred yards to maybe a mile on relatively good locations. So it's not quite GPS, but it'll still tell you whether your bird's in Alaska or not. And that's what PINSAT taught us. So it was the first one to look at how these animals move from California to primarily sonic. Really showed how important sonic was as sort of the pre-staging for breeding birds.
What's sonic?
Sonic. Yeah, sonic is it's an acronym for Southern Oregon and Northeastern California. Also includes Northwestern Nevada, Northern Washoe County, and it's this area of the Great Basin with really sort of clustered habitats in low-lying basins like the Klamath Basin, Summer Lake, Malheur, Goose Lake now, And these areas are incredibly important. And prior to PINSAT, we knew that there were lots of birds there, but we didn't realize how extensive the use was as these birds leave, especially for things like geese and a lot of ducks like pintail that are capital breeders, meaning they need to eat their way up to the breeding area because they're not going to eat very much while they're on nest. So they need to have all the food and nutrients that they need as they make it north, because they're not going to find it when they get up there, or behaviorally they're going to be sitting on a nest and not able to go around and look for it. So Sonic, this area at the northern part of the state, I basically think of it as Klamath, but it's really much bigger than Klamath. It extends all the way to Malheur, and nowadays even extends kind of all the way to Boise. We certainly get increasing numbers of white geese and white fronts that are over in the grassland and agricultural areas west of Boise. And so that's this kind of primary staging area. PINSAT taught us about that, and then it taught us where birds went as they went from that, and that some pintail would migrate to the Yukon Delta, where the typhoon was last year, and they would make that flight directly over the open ocean, crossing it in a day or 2 days, and end up in Alaska without ever stopping. Then others would sort of go up along the coast and hit the islands and inlets along Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, around Juneau, Ketchikan, so on, and make it over to the Yukon the same way. But most of the birds, or a lot of the birds, would go interior into Alberta. And so there was kind of a timing sort of thing. That was one of the big things that they found, was early birds would do one thing, late birds would do a different thing. And that has a lot of implications on what resources are going to be where the birds end up. If they make a bad choice and make a left instead of a right, they might end up in a spot that still has 6 feet of snow on the ground. They're not going to do very well. And it could totally destroy breeding opportunities for the rest of the year, if they even survive it to begin with. It's really amazing to me how these birds all kind of make this sort of, with a lot of birds that we have marked now, we can see large numbers of birds making the same decision to cross, say, the Rocky Mountains to head from Boise or Malheur and head over to, say, Freeze Out Lake in Montana or Alberta. And they're all doing it in the same 48 hours. And I still can't quite figure out what cues they're getting from the other side of the mountains that say it's finally green enough to make that jump. I haven't yet seen birds make really bad decisions yet. There's been some really awful springs in that part of the woods. So they're still making it across. Not always a straight trip, but there's definitely a lot left to learn about migration there.
So obviously you've had lots of years of data with the PINSAT project. Is there any like shifts in migration patterns you've seen or changes in the last 20, 25 years that's just kind of over a timeline scale of stuff moving?
Yeah. So we used to see back in the early 2000s, we used to see over half the birds would end up, of our birds marked here, would end up in Alaska. And majority of those would end up making straight trips from Sonic, either up the coast or straight over the ocean. And they would end up over in Western Alaska. And the remainder would get over to Alberta, and then a bunch of them would come across from Alberta. Looks like a long way around, but if you look at it the way a bird flies, it's not that much further than leaving directly from Sonic. But it was still, the primary path was to go from, say, the Klamath region or Malheur and go across and go west, northwest from there. Nowadays, we almost never see that. It's really, really reduced. And again, I mentioned that there was this kind of timing. We haven't worked out yet whether the timing of migration and that shift in the timing of migration is responsible for the shift in direction. But we've definitely seen this real push towards, most of the birds are now going to the prairies, the northwestern prairies, Alberta, maybe a little bit into Saskatchewan. And then from there, a large number of them are going into boreal Canada. and a lot do still come across over into Alaska, but we're getting a lot of them into Northwest Territories and the Yukon, and even a few birds that are going even further east over towards Hudson Bay, which is not traditional pintail regions. And so that seems to be a pretty big shift that we're starting to realize is happening.
When you get birds like that, that kind of venture off, say, Hudson Bay, do they end up going into a different flyway, or do they end up coming all the way back to the Pacific?
It varies. Most birds do come back. We do get some flyway shifting, and we get more flyway shifting in pintail than we do in other birds. Pintails as a species, if I could compare, say, a pintail to a mallard, mallards are homebodies. They like to sit in their spot. They find their little honey hole. They like, you know, we all know they like big, thick cover, and they'll happily stay in one spot for the whole season if nobody bothers them. Pintail are the exact opposite. They're like the five-year-old with an espresso. They're always flying around all over the place. They never stop. We have something that's on these newer tags that's called accelerometry. And it's basically telling us how the tag is moving at a very fine resolution. So like 20 readings a second. And we can tell from that a lot about activity. So if it's very rhythmic and moving a lot, that probably means the bird's flying, because what we're recording is the wing beats. If it's oriented so that the front is pointing straight down, that's probably a dabbling duck feeding, because it's dipping down. And you know, one of the only reasons why the tag would be oriented that way. If the tag's entirely upside down, it's probably sitting in a raptor nest or something like that, or on somebody's hood, you know, as they're driving away from the wildlife area. So we can get a lot of information from that, and I can tell a mallard from a pintail almost at sight without even a second guess, because pintail just never slow down. They are always on the move, and Even with their, if they're not actively moving across the environment, they're moving more than most of the other species.
So I want to have you clear something up for us. So difference between what you're saying in tags versus bands.
Yes. Sorry. So tags. When I say tags, I'm referring to the transmitters that we put on these birds. Usually these are fit on like backpacks. Some of the geese we can put them on as collars. We're going to try a couple new tags this year that are leg bands that aren't going to be GPS, but they'll still provide us information about location. We get the location of the receiver, not of the bird. But we're going to try those out. It's kind of like this first generation of smart bands. So when I say tag, I'm referring to one of these telemetry devices. It could be a backpack, collar, whatever.
And you mentioned earlier, you know, staging up in Klamath. So when does that typically take place? And when a bird is staging up in the northeast zone, is it like a few days? Is it weeks? I mean, how long typically will birds stage to make their next push?
It can be an extended period of time. We have birds that are still up there now. It used to be uncommon, exceedingly uncommon, almost rare, to have birds that would be in Klamath in January. We've had birds that have been up there all season long, have never come down. We had a bird in Boise even until this last storm. So whatever, you know, very different habitat conditions up there now than there used to be. And it will always vary a little bit here or there. Certain years they'll stay, certain years they won't. Some years they'll go up mid-season and then come back. Usually the larger bodied birds. So it tends to be geese that do that, not ducks. But they can be up there for days. You know, some of them will be, particularly in Klamath, because it's such a big energy dense, and Klamath Refuge is the first refuge in the network. You know, it's built for ducks. That was its entire purpose. And they do a really good job up there. And they can stay up there for 2 months before they head north. So they might head up there as early as the end of February and then not head up to Alaska until April or May. That's how important that is. Some birds will spend more time in Klamath than they'll spend in the valley between fall migration and through spring migration.
I mean, is it like once it finally does freeze up, then they'll come down? I mean, or is it just weather patterns? I'm sure when a storm comes in, your transmitters go all over the place. But
yeah, and this last storm really took a wallop to the birds. I think that the fog this year is something that we don't normally see, and that fog sort of set the scenario for a lot of movements that probably used to be normal. I mean, this fog that we had prior to this last storm was exactly what I experienced when I first came here, almost to a T. 15 days, 20 days without seeing the sun was kind of, I thought that was normal. And it was back in the day.
Yeah.
It's changed a lot. And we know that from a lot of really good measurements. And that we think has affected bird condition a lot as well. What typically happens when the fog comes in and there's no place for birds to go is they get up above it and they fly. And they fly and fly and fly, and they never set down until they have to. The bird just hopes they're making a good decision when they do it and they're not landing on the decoys. They're finding the actual sanctuary and not the decoys. But back in the 80s and 90s, you know, our birds were in awful body condition. There were a lot of other habitat reasons for that as well, but one additional factor was the fact that we would have fog for a quarter of the winter that these birds would have to fly around. And now we don't see that. And we can tell that by looking at how many birds were flying 25 years ago when we used to track them and how often birds fly now. And there's really no reason for birds to get up and fly like that. It's really changed a lot.
That's so interesting, because me and Jeff were hunting during that fog, and I looked at him and I go, you think like when the fog breaks, they're like, oh, this isn't where I'm supposed to be. Like, do they, like, I've always wondered, you know, do they have the sense to be able to know where they are above that fog? That kind of answers the question. They're just mindlessly going around and hoping they don't end up in the wrong spot. But I would just wonder, once the fog breaks, do they all the data points go back to where they started?
And we'll see. They haven't made it there yet. We had a lot of birds. I mean, this last storm really moved birds around a lot. We had birds that went from Sac Refuge all the way back up to Summer Lake. Went the wrong direction. Oh, wow. And then went, got up there and went, nope, this is too cold.
Come back.
Came all the way back down and is now sitting over at Delavan. So you got a bird that went from one refuge, went, I don't know how many hundred miles that is, up to Summer Lake, and then was there for 6 hours and turned around and came back and ended up 5 miles from where it started. And we have other birds that have gone down. Birds that have gone down to Tulare in the last couple of days. And what seems to happen is, you know, birds have behaviors. They have, you know, they have sort of modes of operation just like we do. Some birds really get up and move. Like I described pintail, they tend to be ones that do that. Others tend to be like, nope, I don't like this. I'm going to just sit down and not move. So you look at some of the refuges now and they all look like starbursts. Everybody's just going out from the same sanctuary areas, and they're going and finding the very first field that they can find, and they're sitting and eating all night and then coming back. And so some move less when the weather's really bad, and some move more. And, I don't know that we are going to know in the near term what's making a bird do one versus the other, but that's what I've seen over the last, say, 2 to 3 weeks, is a lot of birds really concentrating in, which makes hunting opportunities a lot harder. We want bright, sunny days with lots of wind, because the birds can see everything. You get lots of movement in your decoys. And the problem with the fog is it just blocks everything. They can't see down below it. They can see horizontally for 50 miles, but they can't tell what's 100 feet below them. And so it's hard for them to find that pocket of water where they want to be. And once you do start getting the fog break, you just hope that that's where your decoy is because that'll be the honey hole.
And Corey, we mentioned the birds going back up to Klamath and coming back down. Like, do you see any trends where they're like birds going down to Mexico, then coming back up to, like, let's say Tulare or Basin? Like, is there any of that on the south end of things?
We've seen a little bit of that, but we don't see a whole lot. And I think that's mostly because of when and where we're marking birds. We tend to mark a lot of our birds postseason because we want to get as much information about the annual cycle as we can. So we do mark a lot of birds preseason because they're easy to catch. There's a lot of efforts. We do a lot of banding and stuff so we can get those out. But if we do that, we also lose a lot of tags, right? A lot of tags get harvested. And so, which gives us great information too. We get plenty of information about harvest just from the birds that are marked preseason and selection, what they're doing. But because we're marking birds principally in the northern part of the valley and principally later, we're not getting as many birds that are going down to Mexico. We get a few occasionally. Every once in a while, we'll get a random cinnamon teal that decides it wants to head down south. But the only bird in the last 2 years that we've had go to Mexico from California was actually a snow goose that went to Baja last year and is down sitting outside of Lancaster right now. It's like this total Mojave snow goose. It's kind of a cool bird.
That's wild.
Yeah. It was last year. It was crazy. It was hanging out at like some baseball fields and the playground at the school and all of this stuff, finding grass wherever it could. It seemed like
that is great. Yeah. That's phenomenal. Like some of these birds that you've tagged, I mean, are you still getting transmission from them like 2-3 years later if they are surviving? I mean, what's the typical, once you put a backpack on one, that you're still getting data on it?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, we're not getting usually a full life cycle. It's hard putting a transmitter on a bird. They're carrying, we have to keep it under 3, but they're usually carrying about 2% of their body weight year round while running marathons twice a year. Or maybe a marathon's a bad term. It's like a 2,000-mile sprint. And so that's, that's the equivalent of me carrying almost a 50-pound backpack. It's not 50. 5-pound backpack strapped to me everywhere I go. And so we do get a lot of birds that don't survive the year, don't come back from the Arctic. I don't think it's actually so much because of the tags. I think it's more because in order to keep the tag weight as low as possible, we use solar power to recharge them. And we have yet to find a nice matte finish to a solar panel. And that sort of glare is a potential source of ID for raptors or something that might be trying to come down at something. If you've got a flock of 200 ducks and one of them is blinking at you, that's probably the one that your eyes are gonna gravitate towards. But we do get tags. We've had pintail that we've tracked for almost 4 years. The typical tag, it lasts about a year, and a lot of those are recovered due to harvest, so we can put the tags back out on subsequent birds. But we've had ducks for up to 4 years. We've had geese for 4 years because they're bigger, more heavy-duty tags. And that data is the real gold, because then we can learn from one individual what makes an individual do one thing 1 year versus something else the other year. One of our first pintail that we marked here in California, went to the Dakotas or Alberta, and then decided to go to Louisiana next year. and went just about as far south in Louisiana as you can go, hanging out around Venice at the mouth of the Mississippi River. Came back up, went back following breeding season to Alberta, Saskatchewan, and then came back to California on its third winter. So
just wanted to go for a trip.
Just wanted to go hang out for a while. And that was a female, which is a little more unusual. We tend to think that males tend to be the birds that move around between flyways. They tend to be a little bit more mobile because there's less to tie them to a spot for reproductive needs or anything. But that was a female. It was pretty unusual.
Just went for a little holiday.
Yeah. And it's not the only bird that we've had do that. We've had a lot of snow geese have done the same thing. Mm. The interesting thing that we've seen with the snow geese is how often they'll actually switch breeding colonies. You'd think if you were born in a spot, the best choice that you could make is to go back and try and breed at that spot. But we do see a lot of snow geese switching from one colony to another, including going all the way from the Western Arctic population in North Slope of Alaska, all the way to Baffin Island, or right next to it, Southampton Island. And on three subsequent years, it just went further east.
Then that has nothing to do with like habitat conditions or anything like that. They're just
it's hard for me to tell.
Yeah, hard to say.
I don't know. I don't know. A lot of the colonies that they go to aren't necessarily visited every year, so it's hard to tell what things really look like on the ground. I don't know that we've ever seen a bird successfully breed one year and then choose to go to a different colony the subsequent year. So it might still have something to do with whether or not they're successfully at breeding. If they go to a spot and things don't look good and they didn't have a good experience the year before, they might go someplace else.
Okay.
So you've talked about kind of the evolution of the tags, how they've gotten better. I know you had just kind of mentioned briefly about the smart bands. So what are those and what do they offer?
Yeah, the smart bands, this kind of new version that's coming out is it's essentially a radio beacon, but it's a radio beacon that uses infrastructure that can give us the location of the receiver. And so traditional banding, we put a band out, we know that location. A certain proportion of those birds will get harvested and we can get that location. So we get kind of a point A, point B, and we get the time in between those two. And that's really the only information we get. How long did the bird survive after we marked it and how far did it move between marking and harvest? Every once in a while, we'll get a handful of birds that'll get recaptured. And so we can get kind of in between information about stuff, but that tends to be pretty sparse. The smart band is meant to kind of alleviate that and be kind of a halfway in between what a GPS tag can get us and what a band can get us. So a device that's really small, doesn't affect behavior, doesn't affect survival, isn't likely to be targeted by hunters. And so we can get unbiased information. We don't get a lot of tag harvesting that can happen. I don't think it happens often, but it could. And we can get information throughout the entire life cycle about where that animal's going. Is it switching flyways? Is it coming back? Is it hanging out in a spot long enough to breed? All of this is the type of information that we should be able to eventually get from these tags. We're trying out kind of the first tech now. These things have really only been available for a year. And so we're going to pilot a few this year and see how well they work. They still rely a lot on some sort of infrastructure, cell towers, this network called MODIS, which has been built out across the country, which is a series of radio receivers. In the not too distant future, I see a day where we have kind of like the tracking equivalent of Starlink, where it's a satellite network that is providing us all this information. Then we're not going to have to need cell towers. We'll be able to get information no matter where the tag is at.
And are these new ones backpacks or are they actual like leg bands?
So these ones will actually be leg bands. The smart bands actually are leg bands. So they'll just be on the opposite foot. We'll have the silver federal band on one side and we'll have this gray or black or orange or whatever color they turn out to be on the other leg.
Interesting.
And it'll just have...
They're getting Fitbits.
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly it. Yep. Yep. And then the hope is that we can use this stuff. So we'll mark some local birds so that we can get some idea of where they're at in the valley during breeding, where they go to molt, get the timing, the same types of stuff we can get from GPS, just a lot lower resolution. But also, like I said, a lot less impact on the bird and potentially lasting a lot longer. One of the types of tags we're putting on doesn't even have a battery. It has a solar panel that charges a capacitor, and theoretically that could last for 50 years. So it's like having a Apple Watch whose battery never dies.
And what do these cost?
That's per unit. The best part. These new tags are about 1/5 the cost of a GPS. So there's still a couple $100. They're going to be hard to make something operational. We're not going to replace banding as a tool anytime soon. They do still have electronics. We don't know how well they're going to work long term yet. Like I said, they've only been around for a couple months. But at the price point where they're at and where they're likely to go in the next year or two, they could really dramatically alter how we understand how populations are distributed, not just in California, but across the continent. And that's going to be really important to understanding things like how habitat and agricultural policies are influencing things here, even when the birds aren't here.
And in terms of like the other flyways, is everyone doing this, you know, across the board equally, or like does the Pacific flyway have more birds tagged and are being monitored? And yeah, who kind of heads that up at the same time?
Yeah. There's still a lot that's done sort of ad hoc in each flyway. There's not like a specific overarching national group that's coordinating stuff. When we started the GPS effort 10 years ago, we were definitely ahead of most folks, but there's been some really amazing investments in other flyways the last couple of years. You know, hundreds and thousands of tags have been put out in Central Mississippi Flyway, in breeding areas and in wintering areas. And, you know, one of the things that I've loved about working on this project is being able to kind of teach everybody what not to do, finding all the errors one of the early adopters, I think has hopefully really helped folks. And it's definitely enabled me to build a lot of collaborations with folks. So even though there's no direct coordination between that, we have so many collaborations with folks that are doing this that there's just an amazing array of data available through partnerships and data sharing. And it's growing still. I just heard of another 500 tag project that's starting this year. So it's not going to end. And there's going to be plenty of us to leverage for many years to come.
That's amazing. I think all hunters in general, just, you know, they're pretty fascinated by, you know, what the birds can do and kind of their life cycle and where they go and why they go certain places. And speaking of that, I mean, this year we were lucky enough to have our 3 pintail. How does telemetry kind of work into that? And, you know, how many pintail actually have, you know, the transmitters on them, and how does that change kind of with the hunting bags and seasons kind of going into the future?
Yeah. So our marking effort was done entirely independent of the harvest regulations. So we didn't gear up to do anything with pintail this year. Not explicitly, but we have marked a lot of pintail in the last year. I think we have several dozen pintail still active right now. I want to say we have a total of about 150 ducks active, and I'm guessing probably 30 of those are pintail. So a pretty good proportion of what we have on air. The limitation that we have with pintail is we don't have the tag longevity for pintail the way we do for a lot of other ducks, because they undergo such long migrations, because they undergo early migrations. We tend to lose more tags either to natural mortality or whatever else. And when the birds go into the boreal, comparatively few of them are coming back. And so it's either tag failure that's happening up there or mortality that's happening when birds go far north. And so compared to, say, mallards that we're marking mostly locally, those birds stay on time and we can find those tags, recover them, and deploy them on other mallards before the pintail ever come back. So we tend to keep our mallard and gadwall numbers higher than pintail because we have so much more opportunity to get them. But more specific to your question about the three pintail limit, the data about migration and movement is hopefully going to help inform how to better interpret things like the population surveys, the BPOP surveys, because those are done in different regions across North America. And they're kind of all assumed now that every number is independent. And we're going to be able to use this migration information to say, okay, this proportion of birds were in this zone when it was counted, and then were in this zone when it was counted, and be able to kind of sort of massage those numbers by using information that wasn't available before, kind of scale them based off of relative occurrence of birds, so that accounts, you know, 50,000 ducks that are counted in a strata that has twice as many radios than one that has fewer radios. And so that's, that would allow us to apportion where, quote unquote, our California birds are breeding, and really understand habitat needs for California there as well. Like, for example, the southern prairie pothole region doesn't have a lot of connectivity to California. That probably makes sense because it's at the lower latitude. Birds would have to migrate horizontally in order to make it to us almost. And so understanding these dynamics about if conditions are bad in the Dakotas, it's probably not great for a lot of hunters in a lot of areas, but it's probably not the worst thing for California. And so being able to understand where our birds go will allow us to tailor what we should expect in our region based off of breeding conditions or weather.
And with that, I mean, are you seeing, you mentioned like you had a bird up in Boise and stuff. Are you seeing where, you know, whatever it might be, climate change or people's opinions on flooded corn or whatever, are you seeing birds staying further north more often now than, you know, 15 years ago, let's say?
I definitely am, but there's a big caveat to that. In the past, yeah, we had to have somebody actively tracking the birds in order to know where they were. And we weren't sending people to Boise to try and find missing birds. So we had a lot of missing birds.
Why not? Why not?
You know, PINSAT was a well-funded project, but it wasn't quite that well-funded. And that's actually one of the reasons why they used satellite, right, for that PINSAT project, was because they knew that they weren't going to be able to send enough planes flying around the Arctic with telemetry receivers on them to figure out where these birds were. So we used new tech instead. And that's one of the things that I'm really confident that I'll be able to bring with CWA to the table for the management agencies to be like, this is what you need to use. This is how you need to use it. And this is why this is so much better than sending people up in a plane to count something from 500 feet away. This is better information. Working smarter, not harder. But yes, short answer to your question, yes, we do see a lot of birds hanging out further north. It varies, of course, depending on the winter. One of the other things that we've seen, particularly in the fall, but I expect it's also happening in the spring, is impacts of wildfires. You know, we're not too far in the past. We had 2020 was that really crazy wildfire year. And that was kind of a late August, early September in Oregon. They had a big outbreak, whole series of wildfires. And that coincided with the Tule Goose migration from central Alaska. And so we had birds that were coming down and they hit basically Vancouver Island. And one of the weird things that coincided with that wildfire event was, what is it, easterly winds. So it blew the smoke from the mainland out into the ocean and basically created a wall of smoke over the Pacific that these birds were flying across the ocean, you know, 100, 200 miles from land, hit this wall of smoke and just sat down on the ocean and stopped. And we had one bird that stayed for 4 days off the coast of Washington, not able to see the sun because it was those crazy orange skies and everything that we all remember. And then eventually got up and flew and made it its way back around to Summer Lake. We had, I think it was four different birds that were all flying, and everyone had sort of a different response, but every bird had a very obvious response to hitting the smoke. Some of them would go big circuits around and try and come around from the other side. So they'd fly almost twice as long as they needed to go from point A to point B. Some would sit on the ocean for a while. We had two that sat on the ocean for a little while and then came up and they were flying straight towards Summer Lake, and they hit one of the wildfires, because there were several around in northern Oregon at that point. They hit this and they flew across the edge right at the perimeter of the fire and eventually decided, I'm not going to get around this thing. I'm going to go over the top. So they went straight up 15,000 feet until they got above the smoke, and then came down in the smoke and got lost and ended up in the middle of the desert overnight.
That's so cool. Oh my goodness.
Really crazy stories that have happened. So wildfire smoke can be, if it happens at the wrong time, can be a really big thing. Now, tule geese are a species that's probably a little bit more affected because they're so philopatric. They really want to go from point A to point B. If you did that to a mallard, mallard would go, yeah, I'm fine. I'll sit here in this golf course pond. No big deal, right? They're much more plastic, right, in where they go, much more accepting of conditions. But some species aren't like that. And you put a roadblock in and they're going to sit in front of it and scratch their head and figure out what to do. And one of the things that we've seen since 2020 is a lot more wildfires in the boreal, these spring fires that are popping up. They're really early. It seems unusual to me to be having such big wildfires in March and April and May. In northern Canada, but those fires can definitely be big enough and are placed in locations that they could impact migration for our Arctic migrants. And I suspect we've seen some instances, but it's a lot harder to look because we don't have as good models for where that smoke is up there.
Yeah, that's wild. I always love hearing those stories about those birds that just do the craziest stuff. It's so cool.
Yeah, I love looking at the oddballs. I try not to make determination of how smart they are by the oddballs, but there's always a few of them out there that just have great stories. Like the bird that just went up to Summer Lake, and it's like, what? It's the first week of January. Why? Why are you flying 400 miles out of your way? So the advantage to having as many birds marked as we've marked over the last couple of years is it really does allow you to figure out who are the real oddballs. And sometimes it's not obvious. We had a bird, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago. This bird hung around the valley. It was nothing. We didn't notice anything different about it because it was in a great habitat and it was hanging around all the time until we looked across like a 9 month period and realized that this bird was sitting in one pond for 9 months. And what we figured out was it was probably a cripple sometime in January. This bird went from flying around the valley to sitting in a pond on one of the wildlife areas and didn't move from that pond for 9 months. And then it recovered and started flying around the valley and made a bad choice, flew to a new spot and got eaten, but which is another truism. Birds tend to do well when they're doing the same thing over and over. They tend to die when they move to someplace new. And that's what we as hunters usually hope for, is wind and conditions to move birds around. Same thing works naturally as well. Birds during migration, when they move to a new spot, they get picked off by predators because they just haven't figured out where the raptor nests are, or so on and so forth. It's almost a truism that if a bird is doing the same thing it's been doing for the last week, its survival is quite a bit higher than if it's trying to do something new.
You always hear that, you know, we need fresh birds. Oh, these birds are stale. It's like, yeah, that's true. 100%.
Yep. There's definitely something to that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy to see it on a scientific end instead of, you know, the armchair biologist sitting around. I've hunted for 50 years. These aren't fresh birds. It's like, no, see, you're right.
I knew it.
Yep. I mean, there's also a lot of variability, right? So there is always going to be somebody moving around. It's not like everybody's doing the same thing. But yeah, it really helps to, rather than having the, you know, whatever few percent that are doing something new, to have, you know, half of them doing something new. That's going to up your odds a lot. I mean, these birds are smart. At least by this point in the season, the ones that are left are smart. They're not usually making bad decisions. They've figured out a lot of what the landscape looks like. That's what they're bred to do. If they don't do that, they're not going to survive very well. So me, the dumb ones taste just as good as the smart ones. So
I hope there's still some left for the end of January here. You got my hopes down a little bit.
Yeah, you know, it's the surprising thing is we have a lot of birds marked. We haven't seen a lot of natural mortality. Like, I know it's a really rough hunting season for a lot of folks this year. It's been tough. Certainly the fog didn't help. But I'm not seeing a whole lot of reason why I would be disappointed or would be frustrated in terms of where the birds are at. I mean, they're spread out. They've been very focused on sanctuary areas. They've been in a lot of spots. They haven't been in the traditional rice. Like, it's kind of a bad year to have our first three pintail limit because we don't have a lot of birds. We have almost nobody in the American Basin and Sutter Basins right now, which is unusual for January. They just haven't shifted over. They usually shift over there a little bit later, but usually we get some in there by now. We just don't have much. And I haven't looked at conditions to see if that's related to how much habitat is flooded or not. But it's one thing that I've noticed is the birds are staying a little bit more to the west. Now we've got a bunch of birds that are finally pushing into the south. So hopefully guys down in San Joaquin are getting a few more opportunities. But you know, everything that I've been hearing, birds are too far north. Birds are all on the wildlife areas. Yeah, that's kind of what's happening. But that's also not uncommon either.
Right.
So the thing that is uncommon is so many birds still hanging out in Klamath. And I'm looking now, we actually do still have a pintail in Boise right now. So it's not just in past years.
That's amazing. Are you able to tell, like, with just, you know, satellite telemetry, to get like a picture of where it's at within 24 hours to figure out like how many other birds it's with by chance?
The only thing I can tell is how many other March birds it's with. And we do get concentrations of birds. Like I mentioned, with this last storm, some birds just being homebodies. I can see like five or six birds all leaving and coming back to the same, roost site, over the last several days. So they've used the same roost site for 2 weeks and they're all going out and feeding in different areas, but I can see them all coming back. So I know that there's a huge population of birds in that pond at that roost site, but we don't know, and we haven't found a great way of knowing yet, is one bird that's out in the landscape is usually not representing one bird. It's representing a flock. and how many birds are in that flock. The one of the next generations of smart bands might do that. There's some new technology. We call it the social network band that can tell you who's next to who, because the bands will talk to each other. And so even if one of those bands gets recovered later on, it can say, oh yeah, back in, you know, January 8th, I was at 11 o'clock, I was near these three other bands, and those bands were near these three other bands at 7 in the morning. And you can, one individual can end up carrying the whole sort of catalog of connections across all the other bands. And that's another tool that's going to really, really revolutionize how we understand, because then we're not just tracking one individual at a time, we're tracking whole populations at a time. And I don't think we've even fathomed how powerful that's going to be.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's so neat. Let's switch gears a little bit here. You're also working on developing some habitat assessment tools. What does that kind of entail? It sounds like, you know, it's going to help wetlands and waterfowl managers, et cetera. What's that project?
Yeah. So there's a couple different things. These are ideas in progress. A few things to pilot this year. One of them is kind of the idea of this extension, figuring out what are the problems that fall through the cracks that aren't things that get dealt with in, say, a incentive program or something like that. How can we make these things more effective with all the sort of random problems that pop up and difficulties? Things like, I don't know, mosquito abatement. How can we reduce the amount of times that we have to deal with spraying and so on and so forth? Or this noxious weed just came in. How do we get rid of this weed without ruining the whole unit because of having to drain and disc it or so on and so forth? So those are going to be a lot of the sort of nut and bolt sort of extension things. Then one of the other things is the ducks that we're marking should be the ultimate indicators of whether what we're doing is good or not beneficial. If we're doing a habitat enhancement project somewhere, then at some point in time, we better start seeing ducks use it. And if we can mark birds and get samples of selection, information about selection from those birds, that's not, I marked them in this pond, so I know they use that pond. Yeah, okay, that's helpful, but not useful. You know, if we can get that stuff more independent, then we can start to assess which incentive programs are working, which properties are working better than others, which properties should we include in incentive programs? How should we aggregate information to provide uses across the entire life cycle so we can rebuild a history of use across animals so that they're not always trying to hunt for the next available thing? One of the difficulties in California is it changes so fast. It's hard for an animal to have consistency here. And that's, we know that that tends to be important. And if your nesting habitat is next to a pond when you start your nest, but that pond is dried up by the time you end your nest, that's a problem. So how can we find good nesting habitat and bring in the incentive programs that will benefit brood water, having brood water next to that, kind of build these sort of networks of maybe regional components or at least a spatial awareness of what's working and what's needed in different parts so that we can put our money where it's most effective. That's what we're trying to build, and using the birds to help us do that. One of the things that's been the most fun over the last couple of years is being able to mark birds in one year and then figure out where they're nesting the next year. Totally independent. I can go out and find nests and put backpacks on nests and go, they nested here because it's where I found them to begin with. But to get that totally independent nesting the subsequent year and figure out how many of these birds are nesting on our wildlife areas, how many are nesting in agricultural fields, how many are nesting in rice levees, where can we incentivize different vegetation management to benefit those? Because certainly for our mallards, that's really the key right now. So we need to find a way to get more reproduction across the landscape. And we're finding some good ways to incentivize folks to do things that we know that will help. Now we just need to see if there are spots that will work better than others.
Yeah, it sounds like obviously you've done a lot of projects previously. You still have your hand in a lot of different projects, but what are you most excited about working on at CWA?
So one of the things that I'm going to be meeting with folks from across the country next week is looking at some of the pintail demography stuff. So demography, birth rates, survival rates, and movement is how we understand populations and population trends. And CWA is pretty much the primary post-season bander for pintail in the country. There's a couple other spots that have come close. I guess they're probably the primary bander of pintail, full stop. But post-season banding is particularly interesting or useful because when you combine marking birds prior to hunting and band returns through the hunting season to birds marked after hunting and survive the entire year and then get harvested through the season, then you can get information about survival and potentially reproduction in the off season. This whole big black box that you just can't get from only preseason banding. And we know that reproductive rates for pintails have been depressed for years. We know that they're going into different locations and that might affect survival. So leveraging these things that CWA has been doing for years, and nobody's really using them the way that they could be. They don't go into the harvest models because it's not a requirement to understand harvest. But I think they're really useful to understand the population trajectories and to get more detail about why are pintail doing what they're doing. We've got pretty good methods to tell us what pintail are doing, but we're having to do a lot of interpretation to figure out why they're doing it. And CWA's efforts on postseason banding is really kind of a bright star in that. And I'm hoping to really work on that in the next year or two.
Well, Corey, thank you so much for one. Well, welcome to the team or the family of California Waterfowl. But thank you for coming on today and telling us what you have done and what the future beholds. But would love to have you on again. Our listeners love listening to telemetry, banding, kind of getting to know a little bit more about it. I'm excited to talk to you some more, but just want to say thank you so much for coming on today and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you guys so much. I'm really happy to be here. This is a phenomenal change, phenomenal opportunity with a great group of folks. Looking forward to the next several years.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Save It for the Blind podcast. You can find our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.